When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, a City Metric podcast. I'm John. About a year ago, I got an email from an American guy called Jeff Woods. Jeff runs a consultancy called The Overhead Wire, which you might be aware of in some way. Even if you don't know it as a consultancy, you might be aware of his kind of daily newsletter or the news website he puts out called the Direct Transfer. Or maybe you even listen to his podcast, Talking Headways, where he talks about transit issues in an American context. Anyway, Jeff got in touch to say he was going to be in London and didn't want to meet up. So we did that. We met for a drink in King's Cross, the district of London where I live, which is conveniently by some stations. So, it really set the tone. And we had nice evenings just drinking and chatting about nerdy transport issues as you do. And then last May, we bumped into each other again in Montreal, where we were both attending the UITP, Global Transport Summit, which is, this enormous transport summit full of some of the stuff going on there was so technical and nerdy that even I couldn't quite get behind it. There's lots of stuff about wheels and that kind of thing. But, we went out for a couple more beers and we were chatting about, I was explaining, I think, the whole Metro Mayors thing at far, far too great a detail for anyone, really. And Jeff was telling me about many of the issues in US transit debates, and we just thought, well, we've both got podcasts. Why don't we do like a crossover episode? In fact, let's do two crossover episodes. So this, what you're about to hear is the first of those. This week, I'm going to be asking Jeff a lot of questions about the public transport debate in America. Why some cities have good networks but most don't? Whether that's likely to change? What some of the political concerns are? And Jeff is basically going to sort of school me on a lot of things that I don't already know. So enjoy.
Hey, John, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you doing? We've been trying to set this up for a while. We finally actually got organized. So this is a great time. How are you doing?
Yeah, for sure. And that's kind of my fault, too, because I think the first time we tried to set it up, I think I slept through. I slept through the connection time. So
this is the difficulty of doing anything with an 8-hour time difference. But we came up with this idea about three beers in a bar in Montreal back in May. Everything seemed simple after a couple of beers, and we didn't think we'd actually have to get up in the morning or work late or anything. But we got there in the end. So
yeah, for sure.
So I figured what I'd be interested in is just kind of asking you questions about the US public transport policy or transit, as you guys would have it, just because I live in London, where public transport is it's just how the city works. Like, if you live in inner London, you generally don't drive anywhere. It's quite weird to have a car because it's so easy to get everywhere by tube or bus or train or whatever it is. And my understanding is that's not historically how a lot of cities in the US have worked. Like, there's maybe half a dozen with decent transit networks, but generally speaking, like, you're a very car-based nation, and you're all about changing that, right? So I'm just kind of curious to hear your take on the state of the debate out there, and whether we're ever going to see significant transit networks growing up in American cities that have perhaps not had them in the past.
Oh man, I wish we would. I think to get to the level of what London has right now, I think there's a lot of work to do. By the way, I love going to London and visiting. And the last time I went, my favorite thing was probably the contactless payment systems where people were just using their credit cards to hop on the tube, which was quite amazing. But we don't really, we have contactless cards, but they're mostly, cards that people load money onto. And then I guess like Oyster, you'd load money on them and then you and then you run out of money and you have to load it up again.
It's weird. The things that are different. Like we've had this thing over here called Chip and Pin for years. Have you guys had that? Because I know you didn't for a while. Where basically you just have like a 4-digit number that you type in to use your card. Whereas you guys have to sign for everything, right?
Yeah, we have to sign for everything, which is weird because nobody ever checks it either. So, but we have chips now, but they're awful and they're horrible and they don't work anything like they do in Europe. So you'd be standing there for like 5 minutes waiting for the card to be recognized in the card reader. So there's all kinds of crazy stuff that we are so far behind on.
Which is weird because you guys are the ones, you're the biggest economy in the world. You've got all the money. How are you so far behind on this stuff?
It's we're slow to adopt things. It's the curse of us, I guess. We don't do things very quickly. Wait for a while or wait till somebody else does it for some things like the chip cards. Because I remember going to Europe back in, I guess it was, my parents lived in Rotterdam for a year in the Netherlands, and that was I remember then, they had chip cards. So I think I remember that they had chip cards and it was so impressive, but not now. And like the last year or so is when we were finally getting them here. So, but back to your original question, I guess, transit in the United States is, or public transport as you call it, is kind of a funny thing because there's the big five and then there's a bunch of smaller cities. And then for the most part, many places, it's seen as something that's only for the poor or folks that don't have a car. And if you don't have a car, you're seen as kind of low on the totem pole in terms of status. There's lots of car commercials where, they make fun of people riding bikes or they test your masculinity if you're, in a commercial for like a women's fragrance or something along those lines. But the big five are the ones that are really the majority of transit ridership in the United States. And by the big five, I mean New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. And those are the ones that actually have somewhat established transit systems. So some would argue that San Francisco's isn't very good. I might argue that as well sometimes, but it has pretty good coverage. So there's this whole discussion now about bus networking, rethinking our bus networks, because we're not necessarily going to build subways in a lot of cities because they're just so expensive. As you all know from, building Crossrail, and as we all know from building things like the $1 billion a mile central subway here in San Francisco or the Second Avenue subway in New York City, the costs just aren't justified for a lot of people in certain areas. So,
I mean, part of the problem seems to be that by the time you get to a city like New York or San Francisco or London, like land prices are just so high that anything you can do underneath a building is also going to be extra expensive because of the cost of the real estate you might be disturbing, right?
Yeah, and it's that. And then, we have these debates online. I know that a guy here that tweets a lot named Market Urbanism, Stephen Smith, and also Elon Levy, who I believe has written for City Metric before. I think so.
Yeah,
is that
true? He's written this a couple of quite... He writes really wonkish stuff about different forms of RER railway and stuff like that. I love his stuff. Just gets so nerdy. It's like...
Yeah, it's super nerdy. And he talks a lot about, those two talk a lot about why the subways are so expensive. And a lot of times we can't really figure out why. There's just so many little different issues that pop up that make them so expensive. And, here in the Bay Area, it's so funny because we're building a central subway that's going from the Giants Stadium, which is the baseball stadium, underneath, I think it's 4th Street, to Union Square, which is kind of the main major attraction for tourists when they come into town, and it's the shopping center, et cetera, to Chinatown. Well, that's not necessarily the best route we could have done, but it was a political bargain made by the Chinatown merchants when they tore down the Embarcadero Freeway after the 1989 earthquake. So in San Francisco, we have these things called earthquakes, and in 1989, we had a fairly big one that kind of collapsed, pancaked a freeway on the other side of the bay in Oakland. And they were worried about, that damage, reaching over to the Embarcadero Freeway, which covered our waterfront. And the Embarcadero Freeway was basically an off-ramp for the main freeway into Chinatown, and the Chinatown merchants weren't super happy about that. So what happened is they decided that, you know, they were going to, you know, pull the political arms of the mayor at the time, Willie Brown, and make a political deal and get the Central Subway built. Well, that's not necessarily the best use of our money, but now we're spending $1 billion a mile on a subway, which has two car trains and also had to go underneath the existing BART tube. And it's caused a lot of, issues for merchants in Union Square. But when it opens, it'll be interesting.
But you always get these kind of political bargains somewhere down the line, don't you? I mean, like, I remember. So you mentioned London's Crossrail, which is a £15 billion heavy rail line, which they're putting the finishing touches on it now, but it's going to run from east to west London through this like tunnel right underneath the centre, and it's been quite a big engineering project. There are places where it's literally you've got like less than a metre's clearance between existing lines on either side. It's been a very expensive thing. But I remember it's also been talked about for decades and seriously talked about for at least 25 years. Like it will cover the line I grew up on out in sort of London's eastern suburbs. And the version of the line that got talked about in the early 90s is not the one we're actually getting. And that's because they've added branches to serve Canary Wharf, because this thing would not be getting built if it didn't have quite a lot of support from the business community. So, I mean, I guess I'm just saying, like, I kind of feel like if you want this stuff to be built sort of pure without sort of compromises to some kind of factional interest or another, then you can go play SimCity. You can't do it in real life, can you?
This is true. There's always going to be compromises and things like that. But at the same time, I do think that here in the San Francisco context, you know, the line that's been needing, you know, to be built for a long time is Geary. And they told us that they wouldn't want to do light rail because we can do BRT for cheaper and faster. And 20 years later, and it's not built. So
BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, right?
Bus Rapid Transit.
Buses pretending to be trams when they're really just buses.
When they're really just buses. But they have their own lanes, and so they operate probably swiftly through areas that have high traffic. So it's kind of an interesting thing to see what gets built and why. And I've been looking at this for a long time with different tram lines in the United States. And, you know, the tram, quote-unquote, you know, light rail transit, LRT, here in the United States is what we're calling, you know, tramways. But we also have streetcars. I got into a Twitter argument recently about streetcars as well, which is also another fun discussion to have, you know, whether they're worthwhile or not, because we've built a few that are less than great at their performance numbers so far.
Streetcars, you know, are they just what we call trams or like?
Yeah, so light rail and streetcars are kind of what you call trams, but streetcars, for the most part, people's definition of them today are ones that operate in mixed traffic with other vehicles. So you could have a streetcar in the same, you know, on the same street as a car or the buses or whatever other vehicles. So you have them in places like Seattle and Portland have fairly new streetcars. Atlanta has one that's been a horrible ridership numbers because it just got built. You know, you're talking about the support from the business community. Well, this one goes from downtown to kind of nowhere at the moment. And they want to build a network, but it's the first piece of it. So it's not doing super well. And then you have Kansas City and Cincinnati and other cities in the Midwest that have thought about building streetcars as well. So, but then you have light rail. So light rail is the kind of like a tramway where you have a dedicated right of way. You can think of, you know, Paris's tram network in that respect. And, we've built them in Houston and Seattle and Portland and Los Angeles, in Minneapolis and Charlotte, in Denver, in Phoenix. So there's lots of cities that have built, you know, they can't build subways because they're so expensive, but we have built light rail. And a lot of those have been fairly successful, depending on whether they, you know, hit their initial political connections with all the business districts that are in the cities. And actually, I wrote a paper about this a number of years ago that, you know, ridership is determined on employment centers. The number of employment centers that you hit is the number of is the amount of ridership that you'll get. But there's still some lines in the United States or at least some politics in the United States that keeps us from putting these lines in the right places.
Can we take a step back and talk about, I mean, you called it the Big Five and then you listed six cities, which really weirded me out. I'm kind of wondering which didn't count. My money's on Philly.
Did I list six cities?
I think so. Yeah, New York, Chicago, Washington, Philly, San Francisco, Boston. Yeah, six. So.
Oh, okay. I shouldn't have added Washington in there, actually.
Ah, okay. That's...
That was my fault.
I mean, this is just a footnote, but like it stuns me quite how much everyone in Washington hates the Washington subway. Like, it's really loathed by residents, isn't it? And like, I've never heard anyone talk about it without complaining.
I don't know if I've ever heard any transit system in the United States be talked about without complaining. Honestly, I was on a train that got stopped for technical issues, like maybe like two blocks from my house, and I heard a guy say, you know, this would never happen in Boston, where they're from. And I was like, well, it happens all the time in Boston. This is something that happens everywhere in the United States because we're bad on our maintenance and our backlog. And there's actually a big fight recently online, in the news. You know, New York and Washington, D.C. are having all these issues with their subways this summer. And Rahm Emanuel, who's the former Obama chief of staff and also now the mayor of Chicago, wrote an article being like, hey, look at us. We repaired our stuff and you guys didn't, so we're better than you. And then everybody shoots back like, you know, you're an idiot, blah, 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 blah. So it's kind of an interesting discussion. But yeah, the big five, I apologize for that. That's my fault that I added Washington, D.C.
I'm just being kind of arsehole who questions these things. Sorry. but what I was going to ask was... I mean, like, okay, a lot of those are kind of the big cities in the older part of the U.S., right? But I'm wondering, why did these cities get build up around transit in a way that other cities didn't? Like, why have you got a network in Chicago or in Boston, but not in like Los Angeles or Seattle, say?
Well, that's funny because Los Angeles actually had the largest railway system in the world at one point, but it was all streetcars, and so it got ripped out when, you know, buses came into fashion back in the, you know, 40s, 50s, and 60s. You know, the reason why a lot of these cities have their transit networks is because they built them before the automobile existed, and they had the density before the automobile existed. These are all legacy cities in the United States. Philadelphia, you know, one of our oldest cities. New York, obviously, is, you know, our largest city. But also a lot of those lines were built before the automobile was even a thing. So and if they're elevated in their subways, it's really hard to replace that with a bus. So here in San Francisco, for example, we had streetcars all over the city as well, and we actually were the first city in the United States to publicly take over our networks. You know, most of them were private, and they in a lot of cities and places waited till those companies went bankrupt before they took them over. But we took them over really pretty early on. But the reason why we still have light rail that goes to different parts of the city is because we have tunnels that we built or exclusive right of way that we have. So coming to my house is the J Church, and we have a right of way that goes up by a park, and you can't. It's so steep that you can't really replace it with a bus, so they just kept the train. So the reason why we still have trains in San Francisco is because we have hills and then we have tunnels. And the same thing for many other cities in the United States. The only one that's kind of an outlier that was, you know, the sixth one of the big five is D.C., where they built their Great Society subway in the 60s and 70s, so and continuing on to recent expansions.
I guess that's the obvious question. I can see why New York or Boston or Philly or Chicago ended up with these big networks. So you've explained San Francisco. And I realize a lot of the big cities in the modern U.S. are relatively recent. Like Houston is one of your biggest cities, and that's really ballooned in the last 50 years or whatever,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously the age of the car, plus it's an oil capital. So, you know, that all makes sense to me. How is it that D.C. managed to build a metro within living memory? What did it do right?
Well, they, you know, Lyndon Johnson, he wanted the, you know, something that could connect parts of the city. And, you know, at that time, they actually wanted to build subway networks around the United States. And that's how we got BART, right? And that's how we got Atlanta's MARTA, you know, system. And that's how we got, you know, the DC Metro. And there were other cities that were looking at it as well. Seattle was looking at it. Minneapolis was looking at it. There's actually some really great reports. And my master's thesis in grad school was actually the politics of light rail in Austin, or rail in Austin. And to do this research, I actually went back and looked at some, there used to be an office in DC called the Office of Technology Assessment, and they did reports on planning issues. And they wrote these reports about the idea for building subways in a number of cities in the United States, in the 50s and 60s, you know, where the idea came from, what they decided to do finally, and, in the final results. And, you know, the only ones that were built was BART and MARTA and the DC Metro. And those other cities, they decided not to because it was too expensive or because it was, you know, they were too not dense enough. And now those cities actually have, you know, light rail systems, but they don't have the metros that, you know, probably would have been a better fit for them. And Seattle's starting to get there because they're building subways through downtown. And actually their subway, that's actually, you know, it's light rail because it runs, you know, on the surface through the southern part of the city. But, you know, when you get to downtown and it connects the University of Washington, they cut the transit trip down dramatically to 5 minutes from like 20 minutes or something like that. So the ridership has been really high.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
But that's a function of they're on an isthmus with a water on all sides and a pretty hilly, you know, situation. So it's just interesting.
The economics stack up more just because you can't keep building roads there. Is that the point?
Right. You can't keep building roads. In a place like Houston, which is, you know, where I grew up, they have light rail as well. And it actually took a lot to get there because, you know, at one point they were thinking about building a monorail because the water table is really high. Houston's, you know, right on the Gulf of Mexico. So the water table is really high. And so if you get to, you know, if you start to dig underneath the ground, you're going to get to water real quick. So they were like, oh, well, let's do a monorail instead. And then Mayor Bob Lanier came in and just quashed the whole idea and transit for a while. So the bus systems got built up. Houston's an interesting example because they actually built a ton of freeways, like a ton of freeways. When I was a kid, that seems like, you know, there was never ending freeway construction because I grew up there. And it was interesting because they actually used federal transportation dollars to build these HOV lanes. And if you've ever been there and been on one of the major freeways, you'll see in the center of the freeways, there's these high occupancy vehicle lanes, which carry the buses from all the suburbs into downtown and into other parts of the city. So they actually spent some of their transit money on freeways, which is a really fascinating thing.
That does seem to kind of typify my mental image of Houston, I have to say. As you've mentioned, like, there are a number of kind of mid-sized US cities that are kind of looking at some form of transit now, like light rail or streetcars or whatever it may be. What's brought that on? Why are cities now kind of, in however small a way, why are they now talking about this?
Well, for a long time, you know, there's a, obviously, I don't want to talk too much about politics, but obviously from the recent election, you can see the differences between, you know, urban places and rural places or even suburban places. And the urban places feel congested. They feel like they want to change and they want to be more accessible without the automobile. And so in the last, you know, since the 1980s, really, there's been a lot of cities who are focused on trying to connect people with the places they want to be, which is, you know, working downtown or whether it's in entertainment or whatever. And so they started thinking about how to do that on a budget without building a subway. They knew that they needed transportation. And so actually the light rail movement in the United States was a function of trying to find a cheaper alternative to the subways of the 50s and 60s that the, you know, were part of the Great Society and the, that era of transit, development, which by the way, in the Bay Area, you know, it was basically meant as a system to build up San Francisco as the banking capital of the West. New York had it on the East Coast, and San Francisco wanted to be that for the West Coast. And so they devised a plan to build this subway in order to build up the density of San Francisco, which actually worked. And now San Francisco is a banking capital. And also,
it was about attaining density the way you can't in a car-based city. It wasn't about
right because you wanted to funnel.
Yeah, for a second there, I thought you were just saying, "Hey, if we want bankers, we need subways. Bankers love subways."
No, it was a way to get the density. Although I guess it attracted a few bankers, but that was the rationale. Was, you know, they wanted to become the banking capital, and banking, I guess, was an agglomeration type of business where you had, if you have a lot of people in the same space, they can do, you know, lots of good or bad things, I guess. But, you know, going back to the construction of light rail, you know, a lot of cities have decided that if they want to be a quote unquote world class city, they need to have a quote unquote world class transit system. But they're not going to get to the point of a Paris or a London or even a Tokyo or a Hong Kong. But they can do something that is smaller and in scale, but still, you know, tries to get them to that point of being a city that people should recognize. So even Houston has light rail between its major medical center and downtown, which is actually one of the highest ridership, you know, new light rail lines in the United States because it connects so many jobs. And the medical center is the biggest in the world. I mean, people come from all over the world to get cancer treatment at the Houston Medical Center. So it's one of those things where, you know, you connect your major employment centers and you can actually say, hey, look, we're doing something about transportation. But there's been also a movement to change the bus networks too. So Houston just reorganized its bus network in order to kind of get more frequency and, you know, get people thinking about riding the bus again, which has been an interesting process in Houston and in other cities that are starting to do it.
I'm curious, what's your sense of how much do you know about public transport in Britain? Because my suspicion is that, like, as an American, you're kind of, your mind will go to like London, and you possibly won't think of like what's going on elsewhere in the country quite so much.
Yeah, that's you know, I'm biased because of where I visited, which is London and Aberdeen and Cambridge.
most European cities will have something, like, you know, even quite a small European city will have a decent kind of tram network or something. And actually, I think Britain is one of the, as in so many senses, Britain is one of the worst countries in Europe at this stuff. And it's kind of easy to miss that because public transport in London is so good. But in a lot of the kind of the mid-table cities, there is almost nothing. Like, we deregulated, back in the day, every city would have its own tram network, and that was replaced by municipal bus networks. And then those got deregulated in the 80s. And since when, you have routes like, I don't know, Oxford Road in Manchester is the one that leaps to mind, which is this main road through the south of the city, through the university district, which has so many different bus companies competing for customers on there because there are so many people who want public transport on that route. But there are other bits of the city where you will be waiting hours for anything. And Manchester is actually far from the worst here because, you know, Manchester has successfully built up its own tram network over the last 30 years. But there are cities in, like, you know, Birmingham, where that's basically all there is. Or like Leeds Bradford is, I think I'm right in saying, the biggest city in Europe that doesn't have any form of transit network at all. It's like a million people in that conurbation and there's just nothing.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, when I read, you know, City Metric, there's all these new instances of interesting things that pop up, especially the privatization of buses, where there's a ton of companies that are serving the same route, which in the United States, I know that there's a lot of libertarians that would love that. They are all about trying to do that and see, you know, who you can serve. And I think we're seeing that a little bit with the rise of, you know, TNCs, transportation network companies like Uber and Lyft, where they're building their own little buses and, you know, using cars, but technology wise, they have routes and things now. And so, you know, the worry is always that you're, you know, the transit agency is already in a perilous position because it's not the first choice of a lot of writers. So, you know, there's a worry that they're going to skim off the top and then the transit agency is going to be on the hook for a larger and larger share of the subsidy for serving the public that needs to be served. And we have a lot of rules and regulations on our transit agencies as well. So you have ADA requirements, which in the United States, the Americans with Disabilities Act makes it so that everybody must be served. Obviously, that's a good thing. But, you know, if you're in a wheelchair or you have a disability, you are going to get some sort of service, which means, you know, we spend a lot of money on dial-a-ride and some other, you know, paratransit services, but also, you know, retrofitting subways and a number of different, you know, operations for buses. But we also have Title VI, which is, you know, civil rights, you know, requirements as well, where you can't just not serve certain parts of the city because of race or anything else. So there's a lot of things that are tagged to transit that aren't necessarily tagged to private companies, and the private companies will take advantage of it. I don't think Lyft and Uber have taken too many strides to try to serve the disabled community. And even today in New York City, you know, there's the Transit Center, which is an advocacy group, you know, philanthropy in New York City. You know, they are, you know, discussing why New York City's subways have such bad access by subway and I mean by elevator. And part of that is because they're legacy systems in the past. But this is something that they need to fix because of the law. So I don't know how ADA or anything like that works in the UK. But in the United States, it's something that keeps transit agencies kind of putting things together and making sure that everything is attended to.
I feel it's important to clarify here that you may have just implied that you don't think that Uber has a social conscience, and I don't think we can. I think in the name of fairness, I mean, obviously it's a very, you know, they think of nothing else but the well-being of the greatest number, right? So I just, you know, I just feel the need to clarify that. Which, you know, there'll be a lot of nerds listening to my podcast, obviously. Hi, guys. Which US cities do you think are kind of the most interesting to look at from a kind of a transport policy perspective? Which ones are fun?
Oh, gosh, there's so many fun cities. Right now, I think Seattle is so interesting because they're doing so much, and they're actually there as opposed to, you know, since gas prices have been going down, there's been a lot more driving in the United States. And a number of other factors, I'm sure, as well. There's probably, you know, telecommuting and things like that. There's just like a, you know, there's probably a whole bunch of factors in the ridership dip that's been happening the last couple of years. But Seattle has actually been able to raise their ridership into downtown and raise their ridership overall, which has been really fascinating to watch, especially since they are building their light rail system. They're doing, you know, different bus rapid transit schemes, rapid bus schemes. They've put a lot of money into their bus networks. They also have ferries and things like that, which are kind of an interesting difference from them to other parts of the country. But it's just fascinating to watch Seattle just because it's just becoming this place where people are going for new ideas, you know, to look at what's happening there because they've been innovating so much. And, you know, Portland is always the kind of standard bearer for that generally, but Seattle's kind of, it feels like anyways, it's taken over the mantle, from Portland in that respect. And, you know, people have always said, you know, Portland's the most European city in the United States. So that's kind of an interesting, you know, change for them, I think, you know, kind of looking back at Portland. And those two cities, they hate each other. I mean, if you think about sport anyways, from soccer, it's the biggest rivalry in the country.
Football, Seattle, Portland. We call it football.
Yeah, football, sorry, yeah.
Actually, the thing I find interesting about Seattle is, you know, as a kid, you know, this was pre-Starbucks. As a kid, the two things I knew about Seattle were it's where Nirvana came from and it's where Frasier was set. And, you know, the monorail popped up in Frasier a couple of times. So I kind of always envisioned it as this place of a whole monorail network. And it's just like this tourist attraction, isn't it? It's just like it goes for like a kilometer or something.
Yeah, it's like one stop, I think. And that's interesting because actually, you know, they've had their fits and starts too in terms of their politics of building more transit. They actually had this huge vote about building a citywide monorail, but then it got knocked off at some point and they decided to build the light rail system. So they have had a bunch of fits and starts too. And they were one of the cities that I mentioned that had started thinking about building subways in the 60s. I think it was called the Forward Thrust Plan. I might be wrong. I'm sure some folks will correct me or yelling at their radios right now or their phones. But they wanted to build a subway early on and they just couldn't get their act together and they just couldn't figure out how to do it. So there's been a lot of articles recently, I think, about, you know, Seattle's rail money going to Atlanta back in the 60s to build their subway. And there's a lot of salty folks about that.
Is there a big Atlanta Seattle rivalry? Because that's geographically inconvenient as rivalries go. It's like,
well, the whole United States is inconvenient as rivalries go. I can't tell you how many times somebody from Europe has said, "Hey, I'm going to Los Angeles. Can I visit you in San Francisco?" Well, no, it's like a 6-7 hour drive or an hour flight. So the spaces are vast. You know, it takes 12 hours to go from Denver to Austin in a car. So that's quite a trip. And I think our speed limits are faster as well than Europe's. So it's quite a vast space out there in the United States.
You know, if 50 years time, you know, you're looking back at a long, very successful career, probably from a big house, in which you've been advocating for improved transit policy in the United States. What would you like to? How would you like the world to look then? Like what would you like to have happened in this domain that hasn't happened before?
That's a really good question. In 50 years' time, you know, given San Francisco real estate prices, it will probably be a small house. But if I can get one, that would be amazing. You know, I really have a different view on the future of the transportation policy than I think a lot of people. And I wish that more people kind of held this view. But, you know, with the advent of autonomous vehicles, I kind of think we're heading in the wrong direction, and not from a technology standpoint, from doing things autonomously, but from the size of the vehicle and our thinking about, you know, what, you know, the role of the automobile. I think one of the things that people are focusing so much on is replacing the existing paradigm with a new paradigm that's just like the old paradigm, which is four-door cars that drive people around. My hope would be that in New York City, in San Francisco, in the Loop in Chicago, I mean, even further out in these denser urban places, that we get these bus networks that, you know, go by your house every 2 minutes. And because they're autonomous, we don't have to pay drivers, which is, you know, major cost is the labor. But basically, every 2 minutes, a bus goes by and you can hop on and go anywhere in the city that you want. You know, if there's a grid system, you can just hop on the next bus that comes across the street you're getting to. And so I think that's going to be something that is a policy debate that could go either way, whether it's going to be four-door vehicles that are running around the city, congesting the densest parts of the city, or a network of transit that actually, you know, works for people and they pay, you know, maybe $2.50 to $3 like they do today, but they're hopping on a bus that comes every 2 minutes and serves most of the city in the grid that it already exists. But it just happens to be more convenient because it comes more often. And maybe there's, you know, express lanes and things like that. Maybe we dedicate more right-of-way to transit vehicles that can get us to different places. You know, there's this fantastical ideas of hyperloops and flying cars and all that stuff that people here in Silicon Valley in California are super hyped about. But, you know, if we could just make the transit, you know, run better and more frequently, I think that a lot of people would adopt it. I think part of the problem right now is that, you know, it just doesn't come as frequently as it should. And, you know, I think people will take a $2 bus instead of a $10-$15 Uber, although that probably will be reduced as well with autonomous vehicles. But, you know, a bus only has to learn one route. These autonomous vehicles have to learn all of them.
Yeah, we had an interesting piece by a guy called Jarrett Walker a while ago, who's an American consultant on a lot of these issues based out of Portland, who was just like clearly enraged by this. Like, he told me he'd written this blog and so they basically demanded I republish it because he was so annoyed repeatedly seeing people talking as if things like autonomous vehicles were going to magically solve the transit problem. And this piece basically just said, you know, geometry is still a thing. There is still limited space in the world. You can't just keep putting cars in and expect that to sort of magically sort everything out. And I do think, like, there is this kind of utopian thinking around it sometimes that people do just sort of think, well, you know, we'll if we have autonomous vehicles, we can take out some car parks and that will solve everything, as if, you know, induced traffic wasn't a phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, people are going to be taking more trips if they have access to more transportation. And then the congestion issue is a major one, especially in large cities. I mean, New York City and San Francisco downtown are already seeing the effects of having too many vehicles with, you know, Ubers and Lyfts waiting for people to, you know, call them up on their phone. They're just kind of swarming. And I think it's actually causing a problem. So the geometry is an issue, and Jarrett's very adamant about that. I wouldn't be surprised if at some point Elon Musk or somebody blocks him from giving him a hard time. I know that Elon Musk has blocked a couple of planners in Canada from giving him a hard time. So maybe Jarrett is next. I don't know.
I think being blocked by Elon Musk is probably a privilege, to be honest. Although it does mean that you won't be invited when he takes the survivors of humanity off to live on Mars.
Well, you know, I hope that's pretty far off. I mean, I'm glad that people want to go to Mars, but I'm pretty happy here.
Well, you live in San Francisco, why not? So, you know.
Right.
So there you go. Thanks to the magic of Skype, that was me in London talking to Jeff Wood in San Francisco. That was, as I said before the start of the interview, the first of two of these we're going to do. We haven't quite scheduled the second one yet, but next time round, I'm going to be explaining some of the British stuff to him. I imagine we're going to talk largely about things like municipal government structures, why we need metro mayors, how we have the most centralized state in the world. Not quite sure when we're going to manage to record that, but in the meantime, you can catch up with Jeff most weeks on his own podcast, where this will also be going out. In fact, that's called Talking Headways, and that's just hit the 150th episode. So, you know, we were pretty smug about getting to 50, but those guys are way ahead, clearly. Just one quick bit of housekeeping before we go. In the unlikely event that you're someone who particularly enjoys hearing from me, which, you know, That could happen, right? Then I am going to be hosting a politics show called Politics on FUBAR. FUBAR Radio is an internet radio station and podcasting service, on which I appeared as a guest a few months ago, back when the politics show was hosted by the Telegraph's Asa Bennett. I'm going to be taking over that role for a couple of weeks to see how we go. I did one shortly before I went on holiday, which you can hear us talking about. Well, we talked about housing. You can probably, that's not very unpredictable, is it? But this week we're going to move away from city metric kind of topics, and we're going to be talking about some of the issues in the LGBT community at the moment. There'll be interviews with journalists, politicians, and campaigners. So, you know, in the event that you happen to want to hear more of me, which, you know, like I said, that's, you know, don't laugh, that could be a thing, then why not check it out? It's called Politics on FUBAR. And if not, then, you know, fair enough, but Skylines will be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.